Hi, John.
It's good to be here at the Majestic, and we're all excited about the Brahms Festival. The first symphony, the first piano concerto. What a bold program.
Very bold program. And it's very interesting. I mean, both are firsts, but the piano concerto is from a very young Brahms. And we know that Brahms didn't start writing a symphony before he was a little bit more mature. So there's a huge gap between the first piano concerto and the first symphony. And yet, it's interesting to see how accomplished he also already was in the first piano concerto. And actually, if you listen to the introduction, it's already the start of a symphony. I mean, it's so gigantic and so and the orchestra, especially in the first movement, is so dominant that it's I think it's his tryout for the symphonic repertoire.
Yeah, and there's that emotion, Schumann having lost Robert, really, that it had this a suicide attempt, and there's always, though, this minor major, this mole. There's always, even in the first symphony, there's these great beauty in, even though it's C minor.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I think that he learned from Schubert, who actually in his works, almost the when a major symphony is written in a major key goes to a minor, it's almost that the minor becomes the resolution, becomes the consolation. I think he was the first composer to really be able to express melancholy in major and hope in minor. And I think that Brahms learned that from Schubert. I mean, he admired Schubert immensely. And this yin and yang that is present in all Schumann symphonies, where one switches from one mood, he calls these alter egos, Florestan, Eusebius. That is also something that Brahms learned from Schumann. And so the both Schubert and Mann are very important in Brahms's life.
Yeah. Well, the next night is completely different. The second symphony and the second piano concerto are very sunny, and I can't imagine. Only Tchaikovsky steals a great line like a cello solo, or a trio
Yeah,
in
for his
there.
piano concerto, exactly.
So very different.
Very different. Yeah, and again, in the second piano concerto, which is a huge a piece, he puts actually something in there that doesn't belong to the piano concerto. Again, very symphonic, a scherzo, which is very rare. And then the big cello solo, which makes it almost a piece of chamber music in the slow movement. So he here explores different forms of the concerto, which are far more symphonic. It could be a symphony for piano and orchestra in a way, but the piano part is, of course, the dominant part. Actually, even more than in the first piano concerto, I think. And he explored, of course, piano techniques that are new to the instrument and ranges that are new to the instrument. It's a very intense dialogue between orchestra and piano. Yes, the Second Symphony is his sunniest symphony, and I tend to like the idea of comparing the four symphonies to the four seasons. Yes, it is summer in the Second Symphony. It definitely is summer, and the first actually is spring. It's not only the spring of his symphonic writing; it's also the spring of his that is represented in the symphony. It starts very cold in the beginning, and it ends sunny and warm. The first warm, and then, of course, in the Second Symphony, you can see that Brahms was a great outdoor man. He just loved his walking in the nature and got inspired by that immensely. You can hear that in this symphony.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to it, the firsts and seconds. It's going to be an awesome program.
That's going to be a wonderful week. I mean, as I said, this is not easy for the musicians and for anybody, because we have a double workload to accomplish in 1 week, and with a gigantic composer.
Yeah. Well, looking at the Third Symphony and the Violin Concerto, we do have a mature Brahms.
Very, very, very much so.
And also sort of dealing with a friend, Josef Joachim, who they hung out, you know, while Joachim was in college. They helped each other. They edited each other's works. I mean...
Exactly. I mean, and in a very good way, you know, this influence of Joachim on Brahms was, I think, very important. Not only... in the violin writing for the violin concerto or the violin sonatas, but also I think the way Brahms wrote just the best violin lines in the whole repertoire. I mean, his violin writing is just really fantastic.
Well, the Third Symphony, to me, what I adore about Brahms is that he really tried to reinvent himself every time he went to the symphony. It's always Brahms, but the third is radically different from the second.
And the third is radically different from the concept of a symphony in general. Here he's not, you know, looking for the easy success. That's actually the reason why this Third Symphony you hear very seldom at the end of a program. Why? Because it finishes soft. Conductors don't like it because the audience doesn't jump up and scream, and you know, if you finish with a bang, like the bolero, you know, people jump up and they love it. Here, it's more an inner reflection, and until you really burst into an ovation, you have to reflect on what you heard before, and it usually takes a while. But the Third Symphony is maybe one of the most popular movements that Brahms ever wrote. This what is not a scherzo anymore, a third movement, which is used in film music a lot, and it has the most beautiful cello line you can imagine. And there you have this melancholy that is, it's tears of a good spirit. Let's put it that way. It's accepting the tears that come through this. And again, I think we see here the mature Brahms. And yes, it is the fall. It is autumn. And it is the turn, and the final part of his life is about to start. And he's very aware of that.
Looking to the Fourth Symphony, it screams to me that Brahms's knowledge that he was such a great collector of scores and knew the past, and to have this Passacaglia, any Mahler wouldn't have touched a Passacaglia at that time, or contemporary of Brahms, but he makes this amazing form in all the symphonies. There's such a wonderful treatment of the sonata form, but the fourth to me is just that. He's gone through it, and this is what he wants.
Exactly. I mean, this is very unusual as a finale to have a Passacaglia. And, of course, then Webern pays homage to him later by writing his Passacaglia. And for him, it's an homage, of course, to the Baroque era and especially to Bach. Everything comes to the conclusion, you know, where did I start? Where did I start? And where do I want to go? Again, this as amazing as the finale is, I think, are these first notes of the symphony, these sighs that have driven so many conductors crazy. What can you do with it? Or don't you do anything with it? Or keep it simple, or keep it very extreme in the gesture of that sigh. Let me call it sigh. You can give it a different name. I don't really know how to describe the start. But it starts out of nowhere, unlike the other symphonies again, you know. Again, the four, I think, is really a lot about inner reflection. And but what's new, I think, or what's even more intense is the orchestral colors and the textures. It's more woven than any other symphony, and if you listen to the inner voices, you hear a lot of avant-garde harmonies there. I mean, the harmonic structure in the piece is extremely complex, almost like his late piano pieces. But after this symphony, he basically said, I'm going to retire, you know? Not like Rossini in cooking, but definitely in eating. And he was, you know, he's 57, he decided, you know, I don't have to write music anymore. Fortunately, he continued and wrote also one of his most magic pieces, but in smaller scale. Or in a more serious way, like the serious songs and the last piano pieces, 16, 17.
Yeah, I've talked to composers who about the double concerto and the idea why there aren't more sort of double concertos. There are a few, but one of the composers told me, he's like, well, it's hard. You're dividing the attention. When you have a violin concerto, the soloist gets all the thing. But when you add another voice, it's suddenly you have two spotlights and you have to focus on two things. And Brahms does this sort of as an apology to Joachim. But compositionally, I think it's very interesting that this is successful and it's done so well, maybe because he was such a great orchestra writer.
Exactly. And it's his devotion to chamber music. All of a sudden, the soloists have to be partners. You know, it's not about, you know, let my ego shine. It's be a partner, go into a dialogue. And, of course, I mean, Beethoven's triple concerto was, of course, the first. At the end of the day, Beethoven has invented any form you can think of. That's the tough thing. But this triple concerto, I think, inspired him to do it. Where, again, the cello part is the dominant part, actually. So in a certain way, it's also in the double concerto, quite an important lead in this concerto. And Brahms is about partnership, not about the ego sticking out. And that's in the orchestral writing, and that's in all of his chamber music the case. And I think as a logic consequence, a double concerto makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to it. It's four amazing concerts, plus you spotlight a couple of symphonies on Sundays, right?
Yeah, on Sundays we do this is a new thing. We do the Discover Brahms series. I hope it's a series that will, you know, be established more and even independently from the festivals. It offers people on a Sunday, and especially also young families on a Sunday, to come to the symphony and go to a 1-hour event. And explore a great symphonic work with a little bit more depth. This is designed for all ages. It's not designed for children, per se. Absolutely not. It's designed for our audience. And even those who came before will then maybe explore more by hearing, you know, individual sections. I'm going to explain the structure of the piece, the orchestration, the thinking behind it from my personal subjective point of view, of course, but it helps listening in a different way. I think it opens your ears, and when we perform the piece after that, I think it opens your eyes, it opens your ears, it opens your soul to actually absorb even more. It's like when you go to a museum and you just stand in front of Mona Lisa. Yeah, it's a portrait of a beautiful lady, but that there's so far more in that painting. Yeah, if you look at the background, if you look at the way she's dressed and everything, and you need an expert to explain to you why that is so interesting. And then you look on, then all of a sudden you understand why it's such a famous painting. And I hope we achieve the same with the Brahms symphonies.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to it. Two very intense weeks, and I imagine in the season's future we'll hear the tragic overture, the academic, and Haydn variations and stuff.
The good thing is
Brahms isn't off the palette.
No, that's why I didn't put it in there. You know, I think that was important. That also was important with Beethoven. We still have a lot of Beethoven we didn't play in the Beethoven Festival, and we still have some Tchaikovsky we didn't play in the Tchaikovsky Festival. So otherwise, you block a composer for a few seasons of that stature, it would be quite detrimental for your repertoire planning.
Well, thanks so much. We're looking forward to it.
Thank you, John. Thank you for coming.